It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo, South America, Australia, France, Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go. We are off and running for this, the fifth day of February, 2018. This is The Horn. I am Bob Kincaid, and it's the post-Super Bowl edition. Yes, that day of the year when there are more absences, there are more work absences than any other single day in the year. This is that day. I'm here. And really, why wouldn't I be? I mean, let me just say this right off the bat. When I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And I cannot tell you how happy I am to have been wrong about yesterday's football game. Boy, was I wrong. But I had to wait till the very end of the game to be wrong. Philadelphia handled the Patriots. And they made Tom Brady look terribly, terribly, terribly ordinary. Pedestrian, even. And given that it was Philadelphia, I was reminded of a quote. It's from the Bank Dick. Philadelphia's own William Charles Duncan Field, otherwise known as W.C. Fields, has a scene in the Bank Dick where he is explaining life to young Og Oglesby, whose name he had remarked earlier sounds like a bubble in a bathtub. And in trying to make young Og Oglesby see the value in investing in a beefsteak mine, which was a complete fraud, Egbert Suisse, accent grave over the E, explained to young Og Oglesby, "Take a chance. Take it while you're young. My uncle, Effingham Hufnagel III, an air ascensionist, took a chance on landing in a bale of hay from a hot air balloon." Oglesby asks him, "Well, did he make it?" "No. Precisely my point. Had he been a younger man, he might have." And when the Patriots tried that cute little trick play where Tom Brady had to run out and be a receiver, and he just completely didn't catch the ball. And a little bit later, the Eagles did the same thing with a younger guy, Nick Foles. I thought of that moment from the Bank Dick. Had he been a younger man, he might have. The younger man, Nick Foles, caught the ball. Poor old Tom, ordinary Tom Brady, did not. And it was the difference maker. That made it possible for, I mean, the scores all, you know, aggregate, but still, that touchdown made the difference. I don't know, but I certainly hope that they took Chris Collinsworth's belt and shoelaces away from him. He seemed positively bereft that the Patriots were not going to win. He tried so hard to argue that two obvious touchdowns were not obviously touchdowns that you almost felt sorry for him. But it was a whale of a game. It was exciting from start to finish. And it ended the way I wanted it to. Sorry, New England fans, it's not like you haven't had your fair share. The Eagles, who have not won an NFL championship of any sort since 1960, finally have a Super Bowl victory. The next team that really needs to get the monkey off their back is, of course, the Vikings, who have lost, what, five? Super 0-5? Something like that. James with a note says, "Allow me to extend a hearty hand clasp. Thank you, Mr. Sousse. Mother, may I hit father with a rock? Respect your elders, child. How large a rock?" It's no longer an English living room drama. It's a circus picture. And there's even a football reference in that line, too. It seemed the universe was coming together to make things happen. To make things happen for battered, tired Philadelphia. And I'm very, very happy. Barbecue Todd sent me a very simple note that just said, "EAGLES. Mm-hmm. Pronounced Eagles. Oh, the Bills have the longest losing streak? I thought it was the Vikings, but Glenn tells me, and Glenn would know, that it's the Bills. Well, okay, we got to... Okay, there's your perfect Super Bowl matchup, the Bills versus the Vikings. Somebody is going to get off the schneid. And it was well played. The commercials, what do you say when the funniest commercials are the Tide commercials? A corporation that has been roiled by a national phenomenon of stupid people eating detergent. It was all great, and for a minute there, I thought we were going to get away with something, because there was no. It took a while before the God bothering started. But there it was. Somebody just had to ruin those us non-believers. Evening by thanking Jesus for turning his attention from some starving child hey kid, just starve for another minute or two. Jesus will be right back. He's got to make sure Nick Foles. He's got to make sure Tom Brady drops this pass and then Nick Foles catches his. He'll be right back, though, because he's Jesus. Mm-hmm. But, you're happy. You got to be happy for Nick Foles. See somebody laboring in the trenches as a backup come in and take the team on his shoulders and carry it all the way through the Super Bowl. 13 games into the season. It was a heck of a display. And like I said, a lot of fun. And Agnes and I watched it together. And she was rooting for Philadelphia because Philadelphia is where her ancient ancestor, America's first environmentalist, John Bartram, lived on a house not too far out of town, on a farm in a house. So that was her impetus for rooting for Billy. And now it's now football is over, and we have the long dry spell until pitchers and catchers report, and spring training baseball begins. But we do at least have college basketball to, and for those who follow it, the NBA to get us through. Just can't get worked up about the NBA. Sorry. Meanwhile, a note coming in from Ron and Raleigh, subject line, the agony of defeat. I'm feeling very satisfied today after yesterday. Not only was it the day of my birth, happy birthday, it was also the day that Tom Brady tasted the bitter dregs of defeat. I enjoyed Peter Dinklage and Morgan Freeman lip-syncing Busta Rhymes and Missy Elliott. That's true. That was good. On the other hand, just about everybody who isn't a freaking Klansman or a Trumpansy neo-Nazi hates Chrysler Motors right now and Dodge for what they did with that. Really? Really? You're going to climb up on the dead back of Martin Luther King Jr. to sell a truck? Really going to do that, are you? He's somewhere in some ad agency. Somebody's, what were we thinking? Well, I don't know what they were thinking, but the one thing they did do is they've got people talking about that ad, which, good or bad, is ultimately the goal. And dear Jesus, please, please, sweet fake baby Jesus, do not let Dilly Dilly turn into a cultural thing. I mean, no. If there's footage of some asshole getting arrested for doing some asshole thing, and he looks up and says, "Dilly Dilly, bro." No, please don't let this be the "what's up" of 2018. Please. Please. Yeah. It was a nice little weekend. We're back at it today. And, of course, the first thing we do when I'm not blathering on like this, the first thing we do is we thank our subscribers. And just so you'll know, if anyone would like to become a subscriber, this day, the fifth day of the month, has precisely one subscriber. And that's our buddy James in Illinois. Thank you, James. We got one subscriber on the fifth day of the month. It would be great to have 19 more. I don't suppose that's likely to happen, but it would be nice to have something like 19 more. Or 10. Because the whole goal of the subscription process is to eventually have enough subscribers that I don't have to talk about fundraising anymore. And on this particular day, we'd need 19 more. So thank you very kindly to James. And, of course, there were other subscribers over the weekend. In particular, thank you to Catherine in California. And thank you to Paul. Thank you very kindly to Paul. Also, on the third day of the month, we have thanks to go out to Renee in D.C., and to Stephen in San Jose, and to Jean and Anne in Fair England, and of course to an anonymous contributor who prefers to remain anonymous. Thanks go out to Janice in Wisconsin. And to John in Talibandiana. So That's all the subscribers over the weekend. Now, where do we stand as far as fundraising on the month is concerned? Remember, what we're trying to do here is to create several days of fundraising-free programming at the end of every month. In order to do that, we have to meet the fundraising goals throughout the front end of the month. Well, we didn't on Friday. We pulled up $120 short. So that would make the fundraising goal $320. And with me gone Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Monday next week and week after, that means there's those 4 days to cover as well. So all told, we have a fundraising goal this evening of $435. I know, it gives me the fan tods too. But $435 to get up even and get through, and it'll, you know, to finish the evening square for 5 days into February, $435. But as daunting as that may sound, there is some good news. And that is this, there is a challenge on the table. So on this evening, if you would like to see your money doubled, that possibility exists courtesy of Chris in Germany. A $200 challenge is on the table for this 5th day of February, and if it is met, if we can raise $200 this evening, 1 at 200, 2 at 100, 4 at 50, 8 at 25, 16 at 1250, etc., then Chris will double your money. If we raise 200, Chris will turn it into 400, and that'll leave us at, $40 to go. So we'll cross our fingers and hope for the best. Thank you. Thank you, one and all. Okay, so, and by the way, if you decide to jump into the chat room, you can get there from either headon.live or headonradionetwork.com. Both have links to the same space. Jump in there with a screen name and a password. You'll be met by Anatole and Ralphs and Steve from Georgistan and VT Blom, others to wander along later. And all capably moderated by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator, Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has folded space to become Man Cave. Yes, yes indeed. And thank you very kindly. Ralph's is putting a $25 challenge on the table, so that your $25 will get doubled, and then that will all go into the doubling challenge with Chris in Germany's 200. Let's not let these opportunities slip away, okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's also, of course, time for This Day in Horn History. For today's edition of This Day in Horn History, we're dialing the Horn 9000 time machine back 8 years, all the way back to February the 5th, 2010. Bob opens this Thorn in the Side Thursday program screaming about the newest round of Super Bowl ads purchased by the American Family Association, which now includes the pregame show. This newest round of anti-choice ads, to Bob's chagrin, include 4 extra spots that are queued up for the pregame show. Little Timmy Jebo, along with his mama, Pam, have teamed up with the AFA, the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippistan, to advocate for taking away women's rights to manage their own innards, Bob quips. Apropos of the follows of watching a Super Bowl game, Bob cites an entirely hypothetical scenario. You know, the one, quote, the one where your beloved spouse sits down on the couch across from you, 2 outs, bottom of the 9th, bases loaded, your team down by 3, and a grand slam will do the trick. And your spouse sits down and says, "We have to talk." And that's when you look over and say, "I don't care if this ends in divorce. Not now, we don't." Again, I'm entirely sure that this was an imaginary scenario Bob was reciting so coherently, every bit as imaginary as the wonderful products from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Have you had your Horn Nutraceuticals today? Next up, it's a quote from Pastor Ray Mummert from Pennsylvania, Tuckistan, who says, "We've been attacked by the intelligent, educated segment of the culture." I really should have gotten that in tattoo form back then. It, you know, it could still work on a t-shirt, couldn't it? "We've been attacked by the intelligent, educated segment of the culture." This quote has made its way to a recently published book, Idiot America, by Charles Pierce, and although February 5th, 2010 does not fall on a prayer meeting Wednesday, Bob picks up Pastor Mummert's Titanic quote and runs with it for all it's worth. Bob then commits to framing said quote and hanging it up on the studio wall. I can't help but ask, Bob, where's the photographic proof? Yee, it's still on my to-do list, damn it. Interestingly enough, as though he wasn't agitated enough by all the Tim Tebow shenanigans, Bob's been offered an interview with MLK niece and noted fetus fetishist Alveda, otherwise known to Horn listeners as Velveeta King. The offer for the interview comes in the form of an email to which Bob responds, "If they want to use my platform to further their fetus fetishist agenda, they'll have to come and take it from my cold, dead hands. Molon Labe, Brother Bob." That's right, wash your melons. And that was a brief look into the ghost of Horn's past, 2,922 days into antiquity, all the way back to February 5th, 2010, for This Day in Horn History. I love the reverb. I do. I just do. Hey, thank you, Libby. Thank you, Libby, very kindly for matching Ralph's challenge, which means we're now just $150 away from matching all of Chris's challenge. That's huge because there'll be a lot of there's a lot of bill paying to do before we we head out to La Grande Palme next week. So there's this day in Horn history, which is always fun. Okay, so Laurel has confirmed what Glenn already made mention of. The Vikings and Bills are both 0-4 in Super Bowls. 0-6 in NFC title games are the Vikings since their last Super Bowl. Laurel says, "I love the ad with the octogenarians having to bust their asses because they don't have either Social Security nor the good sense to consult E-Trade." I'm presuming that Laurel is being a little bit on the sarcastic side of things, because I thought that was ad was in particularly poor taste. The octogenarians who just want to go home and don't want to work till the very day they die. And the idea that somehow E-Trade is going to make it better. No, you know what will make it better? Saving Social Security. Not fixing it, saving it. Not cutting anyone's benefits, not raising the retirement age, saving it. And you know what? You know what might save it best of all? Lowering the retirement age. Not kidding. Yeah, for real. Les, meanwhile, says he watched the Super Bowl through the Twitter highlights. "I'm still with Kaepernick, but glad the Eagles put the beak on Brady's MAGA ass." And of course, that's one of those things that made it so hateful, because Brady is apparently a maggot. And, well, it makes him loathsome. To be that talented and that stupid at the same time, it just seems to almost violate some sort of law of nature. Meanwhile, in the chat room, Anatolsa is using an exclamation point to note that the Browns are 0 for all time. The Browns have never been to the Super Bowl, so they don't have a Super Bowl streak to break. So, I mean, there's that. Yeah. Meanwhile, notes coming in from the likes of Scott and Punky. An 1,100-point drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average doesn't concern me. The better indicator to keep an eye on is the Jonjury, a.k.a. jumping or non-jumping hotel room index. It refers to the 1929 stock market crash when wiped-out investors requested a hotel on a high floor, presumably to hurl themselves out of the window. When the Jonjury is up, investors are really, really down. Yes, so I think that's worth taking note of. But wow, over 1,000 points. Let me share some wisdom with you, because the Dow did plummet, and it's like down 1,600. It has lost all of January's gains in 3 days in February. Mm-hmm. And so, courtesy of Sister Carol Baker, some remarks from the distant past. Well, not that distant. I mean, not this day in horn history distant, but rather 27 minutes past midnight on the 25th day of February, 2015. You tell me who said it. If the Dow Jones, and it's spelled J-O-A-N-S, if the Dow Jones ever falls more than 1,000, quote, points, unquote, in a single day, the sitting president should be, quote, loaded, unloaded, or, quote, loaded, unquote, into a very big cannon and capital S shot into the little s sun at all caps, tremendous speed. Have to yell when you use all the caps. No excuses. And now without the grammatical notations. If the Dow Jones ever falls more than 1,000 points in a single day, the sitting president should be loaded into a very big cannon and shot into the sun at tremendous speed. No excuses. Nothing? Nobody in the chat room with a guess? Internet latency will take a few more minutes. Okay, here. Let me make it easier. If the Dow Jones ever falls more than 1,000 points in a single day, the sitting president should be loaded into a very big cannon and shot into the sun at tremendous speed. No excuses. Which explains why Dow Jones is spelled J-O-A-N-S, why single day is a capital S and a capital D, and while the verb shot is also a capital S, and loaded is surrounded by quotation marks, as is the word points. Laurel noting, apparently Joan didn't like Donnie grabbing her by the portfolio. Okay, quick cowbell to Marty. First in by email. Are you asking if DJT twittered that thing about the stock market dropping? But that applies to black presidents, not to him. And the fact of the matter is, you'd have to have some sort of big-ass board freaking howitzer to cram Donnie's fat ass in it. And I don't think there's enough goose grease to get him down the barrel, do you? Ah, damn it. Michael in Madison pointing out it's a fake tweet. So I've been had. Oh, well. It's easy to get fooled by that kind of stuff. Because it sounds so real, especially misspelling Jones. Thank you to our research department in Madison. That's a fine school up there, and they produce magnificent researchers for the Horns Ad Hoc Research Department. Thank you, Michael. But the underlying reality is not fake. The stock market, which I don't particularly... Well, I'm not invested in it in more ways than one. I don't have any money in the market, and I don't ever have to worry about climbing out on a ledge as a result of what happens on it, because I can't lose anything in the stock market since there's nothing there. So like I said, on both actual and metaphorical levels, I am not invested in the stock market. But a lot of people are, and a lot of people have things like pension funds tied up in the market. And there's a lot to worry about. This particular dump that the market took today, oddly enough, was on the first day on the job for the new chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Because Janet Yellen, well, she's all female and stuff, and could not be left in that position and had to be replaced by a toady more to Trump's liking. And, you know, who knows? Maybe that's part of it. Maybe the market recognized that Jerome Powell has a good chance of being every bit as much of a fuck-up as every other Trumpansy maggot appointee. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Michael tells us, my spidey sense just tingled. Seemed a bit too perfect, that tweet. Darn the luck. But I'm glad your spidey sense did. I wondered. I just saw it late in the game and didn't have a chance to do the necessary research. Meanwhile, from up over down under, Robert tells us the Australian stock market has lost 3% of its value in the first 10 minutes of trading today. I love the stock market. It's like watching lemmings jumping off cliffs. Well, this could turn into a problem. Meanwhile, the maggots and the Trumpansies, this is just a correction. The market was running a little hot, so necessarily there will be some profit-taking and some... A correction, was it? Oh, well, goody. Meanwhile, Steve, down on the Gulf Coast, a member of the Fraternity of Steve, says, subject line, Dodge Ram scam. The Dodge ad was beyond corporate disgusting. At first, just chalking it up to something like the usual hubris attending the creation of these high-concept spots, I had to disagree with myself. This is not about high-octane concepts getting out of control. It's deliberate to the extent that nothing is valued or sacred or simply off-limits. The culture that recognizes the inappropriateness isn't the consumer segment that neither care about nor understands the difference. Anything, even repugnance, sells the product. Best ad, meanwhile, Danny DeVito as the naive M&M. Yeah. I like the Danny DeVito, but the guy on the horse, hello, ladies. I'm in a Tide commercial. You know, that must have taken some doing, because to the extent that they were riffing on somebody else's product advertisement, the Old Spice people would have had to sign off, unless, you know, whoever makes Old Spice is also owned by the folks who make Tide, which is entirely possible in this conglomerated world in which we live. Meanwhile, Steve in New York says, what's really sick is that the reason the market went on the skids, according to a number of reports I read, is because wages are going up faster than expected, and thereby cutting into huge corporate profits. Need any more proof that Wall Street and Main Street are actually perpendicular streets and not parallel? Ta-da! Yes, and you get a jingle for that, Steve. Because I saw that, too, and I thought I had the same thought. Huh, the market's having a hissy because people are actually being paid more money. Son of a bitch. How about that? Kind of tells you where their minds are. But it should come as no surprise. It isn't a surprise. Is it? And, of course, the underlying fear, the economy is getting rather hot, and that means we could have some inflation, and that means that That means that interest rates will go up, and yep, right. And somewhere along the way, I saw some maggot commenting that, well, that's a good problem to have, isn't it? A really, really hot economy. And, you know, if you're one of the maggots, maybe you fall for that. But see, I was paying attention. I remember when Dim Leader began his reign of error, and the first thing out of his mouth was, it's your money. It's your money. The economy's running too hot, so we're going to have to give you some tax relief. We're going to have to give you a $300 loan that you're going to have to pay back, but you're too stupid to realize that. It's your money. We're going to have... It's going so good, we can just give money away. Hey, wait, and then a little bit later. Well, you know, the economy's running. We're probably going to have to do this just to slow down the economy a little bit. So first it was too hot, then it was too cold, and the bullshit tax rebates from George W. Bush were just right. But I also remember that with that round of tax cuts, there were some folks out there who weren't even wearing frayed purple robes with tattered appliques of moons and stars on them and "Will Thee Kiss Me in the Dark, Baby" written in glow-in-the-dark paint across the front. No, they were wearing business suits and neckties and things like that, and they showed up on camera and they said, you know, this is gonna whack the living shit out of the economy here in a little while, and George W. Bush will probably be gone by then, so who cares? And he almost got away with it. Almost. But then August and September and October of 2008 came along, and all those captains of industry, those titans of finance, whom we had presumed were competent, turned out to be just a bunch of cut purses and highwaymen. And they almost burned the economy of the entire world to the ground. And then what they could sift out of the ashes, they stole. And then in turn, we the people, always working on that more perfect union, gave them a bunch of money in gratitude for having burned down the economy and stolen everything that wasn't nailed down. Merca, the greatest country in the history of the world on earth, now, today, forever, in the universe, under God. Good work if you can get it, huh? Steve, with an addendum, lawyers are always doing addendums and stuff, and codicils and whatnot. Steve, with an addendum, says, let me clarify something. People who labor for their wages are making more money. And Wall Street hates that. Meanwhile, with a note to Robert in Australia, Marty says, your market drop is what happens when your prime minister announces he's coming to the U.S. to join the carotene Caligula in the human centipede. Yep. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, you'll see why I'm awarding this. Ron in the far frozen north observing, the Dow Jones, spelled J-O-A-N-S, went down on Trump so fast they should change the name to Stormy Daniels. Yep, we'll do that twice. Well played, sir. Well played. Yes. Hey, thank you, Rhonda. Thank you. Rhonda jumped in on fundraising this evening. Thank you so very kindly. Rhonda participating by the U.S. mail. That's very, very helpful. Thank you. And Thanks to Keith for jumping in. So, let's see. That means we've got $130 to go to meet Chris and Germany's challenge. Libby met Ralph's challenge. And we're doing awesome. So, thank you very kindly to Rhonda, and thanks very kindly to Keith. As far as the market is concerned, Jack Ablin, Chief Investment Officer at Crescent Wealth, told The Guardian, "This was volatility unleashed. It's partially fear of interest rates, partially this new Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, partially the market is overvalued relative to fundamentals." So there's nothing to say that this won't happen again tomorrow. There's nothing to say that it will. But, dear God, what a mess. What a mess. Because it seems awfully unreal to me. And, you know, transactions that are made in millionths, if not trillionths, of a second. There's really nothing they can do to know. If it goes, it goes. Oh, and by the way, I had a note earlier, and it was, and we'll get into more in Monday here, because we got lots of more ins. We'll get into more in Monday here fairly short order. But I had a really great note from Mike in Cascadia. And it goes like this. "Hey, Bob, I've got a question for you if you have time or even if you want to answer it. I live for these kinds of questions. Question is, what do you think of Robert Perry, recently deceased, Ray McGovern, and others from Consortium News?" I have read them over the years, and Robert Perry, for his work on Iran-Contra, will be missed. Mike in Cascadia says, "I used to read them during the Bush and Obama years. With Bush, amongst other things, they wrote against the illegal Iraq war and warrantless wiretapping, and with Obama, they wrote against the drone policy, which I was against. Now, however, they're definitely on the side of Trump with the Russia investigation. I'm looking at an article by Ray McGovern where he claims the Nunes memo reveals felony wrongdoing by top members of the FBI. It is very unsettling. Who do we trust? I used to read these guys and agree with them on the big primary issues. Another one I saw was an interview by Aaron Mate, formerly of Democracy Now! And presently with The Real News. Mate recently interviewed Stephen Cohen, professor at Princeton and NYU, and also husband of Katrina Vandenhoevel. Anyway, a digression. Before our Bellingham liberal AM station became classic rock on AM, what the fuck? Yeah, I know. I used to listen to Tom Hartman. Hartman would occasionally interview Stephen Cohen. That interview was always fascinating and substantial, plus with Cohen's credentials, he's legit. Anyway, in this interview with Aaron Mate, Stephen Cohen essentially says the claim that Trump is a Russian agent is nonsense. He actually says Trump was wise to pursue a normalized path with Russia. So again, who to believe? And more, this time on Twitter, where I follow a group of young journalists, including Ronnie Akalek, Abby Martin, Max Blumenthal, etc. Over the years, I've agreed with them on many issues, including their pro-Palestine stance versus Israel. However, all of them are of the same mind, that the FBI investigation of Trump is not legitimate. So again, same question. Who to believe? Repeating what you have said about yourself, I'm as liberal as anyone. On day one, I was fully on board with Bernie. All those years of hearing brunch with Bernie on Hartman's show put me there. So when HRC was nominated, for a short time, I said I'd never vote for her. However, after my emotions cooled and rationality returned, I knew I had to vote for Hillary Clinton, and I did. I presume Mike to be referring to the general election, not the primary. In other words, the same thing I did. Today, I see many liberals and progressives on social media and in person here in Washington that parrot Consortium News, Abby Martin, etc. I've lost a few friends over it. An example is our two Democratic senators, Murray and Cantwell, here in Washington. Many people, though liberal, won't vote for Murray or Cantwell. They essentially say what you say. Establishment shills, corporate Dems, sellouts. What sets them off the most is that both Murray and Cantwell take money from Big Pharma, and they both were against the plan to bring in cheap pharmaceuticals from Canada. Anyway, I haven't supported everything that Murray and Cantwell have supported, especially TPP. However, when I didn't support them, I let them know it, and I encouraged others around me to do the same. I never threw my hands up and said, I'll never vote for them. I'd rather have Cantwell and Murray any day and every day than any Republican. And see, that's the choice. It's not Cantwell and Murray or a Republican or some weird little acolyte of Jill Stein. My biggest issue is federal public land, and Cantwell is a great champion of that issue. As far as Murray, she's solid on many fronts as a staunch Democrat. So after the long ramble, the overarching question is, what about the media that I used to trust that now spins exactly 180 degrees from where I am now? It's so unsettling and so confusing. And I believe it's going to lose the battle for us in 2018 since it's pulling many of our presumed allies away from the Democrats. I'm really glad that Mike wrote that letter, that email, because sooner or later we have to confront these issues. Hey, how about that? February the 5th and the fleece hoodie just had to come off. It was just too darn hot in here. We have to confront these issues. And the fact of the matter is, all I can say to anybody, because I'm not up for the stop telling us how to read Consortium News, you know, whatever. you have to judge it all on an ad hoc basis. I've learned that over the course of, God only knows how many years career in radio and journalism and so forth. You can't just automatically assume, this comes from the Associated Press, so therefore it's the garbage. For the most part. If it comes from Newsmax, it's garbage. If it comes from Red State, garbage. If it comes from just about any of those right-wing cesspits, garbage. But the problem is that on that spectrum, the other side views things like Consortium News as a left-wing cesspit. And bless their hearts, the folks that you mentioned, Mike, are people who are so invested in their leftness that they feel like they have to adopt these positions in order to remain left. They seem incapable of holding two things that appear to conflict but don't really in their mind at once. For instance, no one's actually saying that Donald J. Trump, the Nectarine Nero, is a Russian agent. The question is more in the way of, is he a dupe? Is he a stooge? Is he so obsessed with the acquisition of wealth and keeping people from finding out how broke he really fucking is that he'll do anything for money? It is, in point of fact, a case of circumstantial evidence in some instances. The fact that Donald Trump burned everybody who ever did a business deal with him in the United States, banks, financiers, whatever, he has ripped off drapers, drywall hangers, carpenters, carpet installers. Anybody who has ever done business with Donald Trump has been ripped off. And on the high finance end of things, that meant that he had to go abroad looking for people that he deemed to be stupid enough to do business with him. And in a Russia that is awash in money from hydrocarbons and various mining interests, and who need to tidy up the money a little bit, he found willing, if potentially very violent, partners. And those trails are out there. On the other hand, people like Devin Nunes actually said, there's no evidence that George Papadopoulos ever met with Donald Trump. Except for the photograph of him, you know, meeting with Donald Trump. So I think the shorthand answer is that I judge everything based upon, or I judge everything on an ad hoc basis. I try to read hard news as much as I possibly can. I'm extremely skeptical of blog sites, whether it's Politicus USA or Politicall News, or because I'm going to see an agenda at work, and that's cool as long as you can identify the agenda and know that one is being fed to you. About the best thing you can do is try to find good old-fashioned who, what, when, where, why, how, and how much journalism. You know, what we might call Jack Webb journalism for those of us of a certain generation. Just the facts, ma'am. And when it comes to opinionators, and look, I'm an opinionator, okay? I don't bullshit you. I have opinions. And I try to form them based upon my understanding of what I'm reading. And there was so much investment in the cult of Clinton hating that to actually full-throatedly acknowledge what a goddamn disaster Donald Trump is, and what a bunch of racists and Nazis and Klansmen and xenophobes and bigots they're his economically anxious base is a bridge too far for a lot of people who consider themselves the diehard left. In some ways, it's proof of the success of the 25-year industry that the right wing built in Clinton hating. They succeeded in getting it adopted on the further reaches of the so-called left. who in many instances just turn out to be too cranky to be able to admit they were wrong. There is, you can find them all over the place. People who just can't say our country would be vastly better off if Hillary Clinton was president. People who can't look at North Korea and say that we would be better off with a more seasoned professional in the White House. People who cannot look at the Twitter feed of Donald J. Trump and say, we'd be better off with if we had a president who wasn't spending all of her spending the first 6 hours of her day eating Egg McMuffins and watching Fox and Friends and tweeting out threats against the life of a member of Congress, as Trump did today. He tweeted that Adam Schiff must be stopped. Now, calling... He's an incumbent Democratic congressman from California, and he's not going anywhere. He'll be reelected as long as he wants to be reelected, I suspect. Trump said that he has higher ambitions. Well, maybe he'd like to run for Dianne Feinstein's seat if ever she retires. But it's that line, that Adam Schiff must be stopped, that arguably it gets up and tap dances into the realm of violating the federal law, say in terms of threatening harm to a member of Congress or calling for harm to be done to a member of Congress. There's too much, there is entirely too much smoke around the Russia investigation for there to be no spark under the kindling. That's how I see it. And if, for instance, you watch things like that Dutch documentary, the Nasty Friends of Donald Trump or whatever it's called, it's laid out there, the connections. So, you trusted Mike, speaking directly to Mike, but to everybody else, you know, you trusted someone because, or someone's writing because it seemed rational, cogent, and also aligned with your beliefs. And we all know how dangerous those beliefs are. Single most dangerous word in the English language. Anatole in the chat room, meanwhile, saying, we'd be at war with Iran if Hillary was chosen. Bullshit. That's just bullshit. There's nothing to indicate that. The Iranian deal was struck by the Obama administration, of which she was a part, and put together by her successor at the Department of State after a bunch of front-end work by her. The Hillary hate is just profound. And it verges into the unreasoning, the pure malicious crap. Now, on the other hand, here's a story, and again, you gotta pay attention to your sources. But this comes from the Daily Mail in the UK. And so, how much of a grain of salt do you take it with? Might be a lot. Here's the headline. A nuclear first strike of North Korea is tempting, says legendary U.S. diplomat Henry Kissinger, as Kim Jong-un warns Trump is pushing towards war. Well, if you go on and read the article, apparently old Hank, Henry, we could make America great again if it wasn't for the Jews, Hank, Henry, the Jews. Henry Kissinger, who should be rotting in a cell somewhere, for what he did to Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, for the complete disregard for anything resembling the sanctity of human life, for what he did in Chile and other parts of the globe, other countries. He should have stood in the dock and been charged and charged and charged and charged again. He should not walk free in a world that is serious about, or professes to be serious about, human rights. We talk about things that age well, tweets that don't age well. Over on Twitter, Putintane, yes, sent me an old tweet from Anthony Bourdain. He tweeted it yesterday. Bourdain said, "Frankly, I've come to regret things I've said." This from 2001. Is not one of those times. Once you've been to Cambodia, you'll never stop wanting to beat Henry Kissinger to death with your bare hands. You will never again be able to open a newspaper and read about that treacherous, prevaricating, murderous scumbag sitting down for a nice chat with Charlie Rose or attending some black tie affair for a new glossy magazine without choking. Witness what Henry did in Cambodia, the fruits of his genius for statesmanship, and you will never understand why he's not sitting in the dock at The Hague next to Milosevic. Precisely. Now, here's the problem with Hank the K talking about a preemptive military action or increasingly tighter sanctions and intimating that such a preemptive strike might be the way to go, you know, starting a war on the Korean Peninsula that will result in untold numbers of deaths. last week speaking to the Senate Armed Services Committee. Why? And I would ask that of Democrats or Republicans. Why would you even consult? I mean, Jesus Christ. It's like having Jack the Ripper testify in front of the Senate regarding ladies' lingerie. He told a meeting of the Senate Armed Services Committee last week that North Korea poses the most immediate threat to global security, arguing that denuclearization of the regime must be a fundamental American foreign policy goal. And see, it's all a question of how you're viewing that glass, half empty or half full, and whether it's half empty or half full of, you know, cyanide. Because there are many of us out here who would argue, and convincingly so, I might add, that Donald J. Trump is, in fact, is the most immediate threat to global security. That he is, in fact, mad. That the elevator don't go all the way to the top. That he's a bulb or two shy of a chandelier. A ham sandwich short of a picnic lunch. And that having that kind of a person within reach of the nuclear football creates a situation of instability terrifying to thoroughly contemplate. But there he was, Henry Kissinger, blathering away in front of the Senate of the United States. The North Koreans, meanwhile, are suggesting that the Trump regime aims to provoke a nuclear war which will undermine the improvement of inter-Korean relationships and the easing of tensions. That's what the North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho said in a letter to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Now, here's where this becomes a problem. And it's a real conundrum. Because one of the most off-putting things for me about Hillary Clinton during the election was the fact that she bragged about her friendship with this self-same Henry Kissinger. And I was not alone in being nauseated by that fact. So one may presume that to the extent Kissinger is giving this advice to the Republican-dominated Senate with Trump in the White House, this is one of those things that would not have been different had Hillary Clinton become president. Warmonger's gonna monger. The question, of course, is the extent to which A president, damn, I think there was a bone in my water. The extent to which a president will take the advice of someone like Henry Kissinger. Sparky pointing out, we're safe for the next 2 weeks. The Olympics are starting in South Korea this week. Mike Pence is going. Oh, dear God. I presume Mother is going with him. So, maybe. Yeah, maybe we're okay for the next 2 weeks. And hey, welcome to where we are. A couple of weeks ago, we were celebrating the fact that the government was going to reopen for a couple of weeks. And now we're wondering if we can keep it open. This nation was begun on some highfalutin, high-minded ideals. And we all know what the shortcomings were. But they were highfalutin, high-minded ideals that presumed that the government would be able to keep its shit together well enough to pass a bill every year and pass a budget every year and keep the thing a going concern. The Republicans in Congress can't even do that for 2 fucking weeks now. And we've got a president in the White House that we're not sure can keep it together between bedtime and wakey-wakey eggs and bakey time. And it comes at us faster and faster and faster and faster. Dallas Ken says, for the first time since the 2016 election, we agree on one thing, Kissinger. Well, I guess that's a good thing. There's really something spectacularly wrong with a person who says that Henry Kissinger has anything, even the tiniest iota of measurable something known to science, to offer to America's political, civic, and socioeconomic discourse. I have a short list of people that I am willing to go out and break my liquor vow over when they die. Henry Kissinger is way up near the top of the list if he's not at the top. I mean, he's above George H.W. Bush. He's above W. He's even above, I know. He's even above Count Dicula. I mean, this is, you know, when I wake up or when I get some sort of alert some beautiful day, and I don't care if it's raining cats and dogs or hailing or there's another derecho blowing through here. On the day that the news alert comes through that Henry Kissinger is dead, it will be a beautiful day. Ron and Raleigh pointing out there's something wrong, very wrong, with our political class. The fact that people like Henry the K and John Negroponte seem to find favor with both parties, causing untold mayhem as they go. These ghouls have as much blood on their hands as Pol Pot. Hell, in some ways, Kissinger is why Pol Pot. And see, it's little moments like this where the entrenched and intransigent so-called left... Ha! What left? Gets a little bit of traction. Because, you see, there are Democrats and there are Republicans who are more than happy to listen to anything that bloodthirsty goddamn monster has to say in his growly, grumbly, Dr. Strangelovian voice.
Now, you see, we must stabilize the Korean Peninsula, you understand. And if we must act pre preemptively and unilaterally, since that is what the United States must do to preserve world peace. We must make war to preserve peace. This makes perfect sense because I have a demon's brain, you understand. It does not make perfect sense in human's brain. But I am not human, you see. I am a demon.
And see, they take a little tiny thing like that and they extrapolate it more broadly into all Democrats are the same as all Republicans. It is as though they are incapable of critical reasoning. Here's one. Let me see if I tag on it. The FBI. And I would submit that by way of answering Mike and Cascadia's question, anyone who is everything one thing or everything the other makes themselves suspect. And I'll include myself within that overall universe. I say no collaboration. And I think that's the right way to go. But I also have to rethink it from time to time. The Democrats could have said no collaboration, and they could have let a whole lot of the most fragile people in the United States, the most precariously placed people in the United States, hang fire. Fuck them, y'all. No collaboration. Or they could go about the business of trying to at least keep minimal services coming. Hoo-wee! We got CHIP funded for 6 years. Why? Somebody explain to me why it is that we have to authorize CHIP for 6 years, and why, in fact, taking care of our children isn't something that is fucking perpetual and that we fund hell or high water before, you know, some other things get funded, like the presidential golf budget. But there's two things can be true at the same time. And the real talent lies in being able to keep those two things in one's head without immediately beginning to yell, "Neoliberals, establishment shills, Joe can win." And here's a for instance, the FBI, of course, via the special prosecutor and before the special prosecutor, just the FBI was investigating Donald Trump. A question. Why is it necessary for these true non-believers to be out there hooting that there's nothing to the Trump-Russia connection? What is their agenda? If there's nothing there, let the thing play out and then say, okay, I wrote an article once and I said there was nothing to it and now I'm right. Yay me. Why the constant drumbeat? Now, I'm sure there are some, tree beard and celery types out there going, "Dude, you're like being McCarthyite, dude." Which, of course, is so much unmitigated crap. And it gets me very irritated. But the FBI is doing a job that it is statutorily charged with doing. Maybe in a perfect world, a certain segment of our, a certain tiny segment would say, you know, we don't need the FBI. The FBI should be broken into a million tiny pieces. JFK said that about the CIA, as a matter of fact. Yes, he did. And it would be nice, you know, well, as Madison observed, if men were angels, we would have no need of government. We're extremely short on angels. Steve from Georgistan says they don't want to get caught with their hand in the Russian cookie jar, Bob. Well, it depends on what one means by that. But there's a lot of Russian money that has gone to supporting a lot of alternative journalism. A lot of people were cashing checks from RT, and some still are, and find no conflict in doing that. Literally working for Putin, who, I don't care what you say, I don't care what any of them say, is not a nice guy. Anybody who looks favorably on tormenting and murdering gay people in his own country, he's not going to be somebody I'm going to respect. Anybody who looks favorably on the torment and murder of journalists in his own country is not going to be somebody I'm going to respect, and it's not going to be somebody that I'm going to ally myself with. But there are people who have and who do. There are people who, for instance, still somehow view Russia as the Soviet Union and think that there's some connection to their own leftism with the right-wing authoritarian autocracy of the modern Russian Federated State. The only resemblance between Soviet communist Russia and the present Russia is its reliance on brutal autocracy, bloody autocracy. And that's not just a modern versus Soviet. Hell, that's the entire history of Russia. Brutal, bloody autocracy. So it seems to me. You know, by the way, speaking of brutal autocrats, I guess I was the only one that really paid any attention to it, but we all know what a giant screaming fraud Dr. Oz is. But Dr. Oz is also of Turkish heritage. And so, lo and behold, one of the first ads I saw during the Super Bowl last night was for Turkish Airlines. Voiceover by Dr. Oz. Turkish Airlines, of course, is the state flag airline of Turkey, which is now a brutal autocracy under the thumb of Tayyip Erdogan. And in his voiceover, again, for an airline, Dr. Oz says that there are a million tiny miracles in the human body. Because, you know, Dr. Oz pushes bullshit quackery and alternative medicine that is not anywhere resembling science. He is on his side of the street. He works one side of a street that has Gwyneth Paltrow on the other, okay, and her goop or whatnot, and things and selling things for women to put in their vaginas that ought never be put in a woman's vagina.
Jade eggs.
I wouldn't be surprised to find out that Gwyneth Paltrow has been on the Dr. Oz show. He, like Dr. Phil, is someone who was catapulted to fame and fortune by Oprah Winfrey. But there was Dr. Oz giving a voiceover pitch for an airline that's run under the autocratic rule of a brutal dictator. Whenever you say dictator now, you have to say brutal in front of it, you understand. And the human body has millions of tiny miracles. And what immediately occurred to me was, well, what if they're not miracles, Doc? What if they're actually the amazing result of millions of years of biological evolution? What if they can be described scientifically instead of described as magic? Because it would appear that even though he's an MD, Dr. Oz lives in what the late Dr. Carl Sagan referred to as a demon-haunted world, where miracles predominate over science, and, well, I guess everybody has to pray when they get on a Turkish Airlines plane and hope some of those miracles will keep the plane in the air at 33,000 feet and not let them go plunging to the earth because the magic wore off. I don't know about you, but I don't want to fly any magic airlines. Closest I want to get to flying in the air by magic is to watch Bugs Bunny do it. But I mentioned that for a reason. We have an administration that has a coziness for autocrats, whether it is Duterte, Erdogan, who let his who sent his thugs to beat the living hell out of American citizens in Washington, D.C., and we said practically nothing about it. To, of course, yes, Putin. And all I can suggest is that you have to. Yeah, you have to see if anybody see what axe is being ground underneath the writing that is being presented. Again, the FBI is in, via the special prosecutor, is investigating Donald Trump. And my inclination is to say, let the FBI do its job. This does not mean that I walk around wearing FBI underwear and an FBI hat and an FBI shirt because I'm a hopeless little FBI fanboy. I know the history of the FBI. I know the abuses that it perpetrated under, and most of those abuses happened under, yeah, J. Edgar Hoover, otherwise known as Vivian Vance in drag. Attempts were made to rein in the FBI after Hoover's demise. Remember, we have an FBI deputy director, I believe. Wasn't he deputy director? Mark Felt, who turned out to have been Deep Throat, who helped bring down Richard Nixon because Richard Nixon was a walking wad of criminal conduct and conspiracy and burglary and vile, un-American, anti-constitutional paranoia. Yes, yes, the same Richard Nixon who, as noted earlier, used to have lengthy conversations with Henry about the goddamn Jews and the hippies. Yeah, you get my meaning, I trust. But at the same time the FBI is doing that, they can be doing something really nasty elsewhere. Sandra pointed this out to me a couple of weeks back. The FBI is looking for terrorists. Civil rights advocates say it is targeting people engaged in free speech. The name of the article is a court case in Texas, the first prosecution of a black identity extremist. The case of Christopher Daniels. A man whose home was raided by the FBI. You know the look, the bulletproof vests, the helmets, the automatic weapons. Daniels was arrested. Items seized during the raid on Daniels' apartment included two firearms, a Taurus 38 Special, and an AK-style assault rifle. He had a domestic assault bust conviction in 2007 back in Tennessee. This was in Texas. And the government says it's illegal for him to possess firearms as a result. The FBI also seized a book called Negroes with Guns by Robert F. Williams. Robert F. Williams advocates armed resistance to racism. He'd been under FBI surveillance for 2 years. He was not going by Christopher Daniels anymore. He was going by Rockham Balogun. He's been indicted for unlawful possession of a firearm, and he's been in custody since he was arrested in December. And his friends say that he was targeted by the FBI because of his political beliefs and anti-law enforcement rhetoric. And, of course, in the Trump era, we now have, and you probably remember when the story was released, you have a bunch of white people now worried about black identity extremists. Well, the black identity extremist classification has grown from a report on paper to a national investigation of Black Lives Matter and black gun ownership advocates. That was his brother writing about the arrest. Rakim Balogun has been classified as BIE. We must defend him. This is a continuation of COINTELPRO in a modern-day form, Balogun, Chris Daniels, said in a telephone interview. FBI not commenting. The problem is the exploitation of a fuck-up he made. What's that old Latin phrase, ignorantia juris non excusat? Most anybody in the United States could be hung on that one. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. It's no defense. The FBI could not have arrested him for being in possession of a book about a book advocating armed resistance to racism. It would have been laughed out of court before it even got up the first two steps. It was the guns, the goddamn guns. you're not allowed to possess them, possessing them opens a door for people to stick your ass in jail. But it does. It looks like the FBI did target this guy because he made himself a target and invited, more or less invited their scrutiny. He is, I guarantee you, like many, he's no threat whatsoever. And had he been left alone, he would have simply been gone on being ignored. But we live in a paranoid state, and we're not likely to stop being in a paranoid state anytime soon. Since September 11th, 2001, we have been in absolute clenched, bowel-watering terror. Or apparently a majority of this country is. And it's beginning to have negative impacts. Beginning? No, it's just having negative impacts. From our paranoia over North Korea to the ongoing paranoia that keeps us in Afghanistan, to the paranoia that motivates us to sell arms to Saudi Arabia and Israel. You know, on top of the fact that it's also very good business. Ron and Raleigh, see, this is how easy it is. What the... They let Cloven Bundy and his gang of thugs go, but they throw a brother in jail. 2 years of surveillance? How many man hours at what cost to the American people? They banned the new Jim Crow, a book, in North Carolina prisons. Precisely my point. When you know the world you live in, and you know that a Cloven Bundy can walk free, and that it took practically an act of Congress to get him charged in the first place, it is wisest not to invite that level of scrutiny. But again, this is a Justice Department that is run by Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III. Are we surprised? You know, the problem with Trump is that he's acting so goddamn guilty. If you're as innocent as you say you are, sit back and be innocent. Because Trump's not a black man. And they're not going to go through his door in the middle of the night and drag him out into the street in his underwear. He's clothed in white executive privilege. And so that's one of the questions that I ask, and this is all occasioned by what Mike wrote. That's one of the questions that I ask is simply, why all the crowing about how innocent he is when simply letting the process work and letting him be innocent at the end of it is all that's required? Cui bono, y'all. To whom the good? Who benefits? Thank you very kindly to Mitch. Bob, I appreciate your comments on Kissinger. I lost some friends to the Chilean military dictatorship of General Pinochet. Kissinger's buddy. Thank you, Mitch. And I appreciate your help. So that takes us down to $110 to go to meet Chris's challenge. Your 110 gets doubled. Your 10 gets doubled. Your 5 gets doubled. And we've got about an hour and 20 minutes to make it all up, or make up that ground. $110 bucks in an hour and 20 minutes. Maybe don't wait for somebody else to do it. Especially, you know, no offense. If you never have, and you can, it's wonderful to have more participation from the community. Okay? Thanks. $110 bucks to go. James with a note. When it all goes south, the old standby sermon, why bad things happen to good people. You know, I've never been one to worry so much about that as much as I worry why good things happen to bad people. Meanwhile, Ron pointing out with regard to the stock market plunge. The drop in the stock market seems to prove my thesis that there is an inverse relationship between the economy of working people and the investment class. The sell-off of stocks is related to an adjusted 3% yearly wage increase and the fear of inflation, this after 30 years of flatlining wages and near zero inflation. So folks getting a little more of the fruits of their labor sends the investing class into a frenzy of selling. The stock market is not an indicator of the health of the economy except as a negative indicator of the financial health of working people. Am I on the right track? Oh, you're on the right track, Ron, and you got the engine going about red hot. It is a strange and perverse reality that a country that refers to itself as having democratic notions runs on an economy in which working people making a little bit more money sends the people with the money into a tizzy. Pathetic. Also not a good sign. Going back to Kissinger, Flavio, and I remember it well, Flavio notes, Hillary said Kissinger was her mentor. They're really good buddies, just saying. Hillary or Trump? Of course Hillary. But, no, the buts were always there. And the buts remain there, but you can deal with the buts at the same time that you say this country would be manifestly better off just in terms of the things that we haven't had to wouldn't have had to deal with if she were president. Neil Gorsuch? Anybody? Can we say that yet, that it would have been better not to have had Neil Gorsuch land on the Supreme Court? I don't have any problem saying that. Randy with a question. It's just an email with a subject line only. Establishment shill? Flavio points out, a Mexican friend of mine put it this way. The U.S. is in an upside-down world where the left is cheering for the secret police and the right thinks they're part of a deep state conspiracy. I'd love it if Trump were stopped by Mueller, but I'm hesitant to put all my eggs in one basket, if you know what I mean. And I do. And the fact of the matter is, looking to Congress to do anything about Mueller, or to do anything about Trump is wishful thinking in the extreme. Because it's not. Which takes us back to 2018, November 6th. And what happens here. By the way, some good news. And this is really good news. Last week, Thursday and Friday, I discussed at some length the gerrymandering case in Pennsylvania, where the Republican president, Senate President Pro Tem, told the court to go stuff itself, go chini itself, and refuse to follow a court order. Well, Ian Millhiser over at Think Progress today pointed out a win. Because today, mirabile dictu, Supreme Court Justice Sammy Alito rejected the petition of the Republicans in Pennsylvania and basically sent their gerrymandering plan packing. Ian Millhiser writes, "Though stay requests such as this one are directed to a single justice, as a matter of process, that justice typically refers the matter to the full court if they believe that the request raises a serious legal argument. The fact that Alito, a staunch conservative, unilaterally denied this request speaks to the weakness of the GOP's claims." So now, presumably, Pennsylvania will have to be redistricted in a non-gerrymandered fashion, which could go a long way toward helping in November 2018, assuming that the Democrats can get their shit together. And that is a giant assumption. And that's one other thing in Mike's Mike and Cascadia's note. I think we might be making a mistake if we assume that a lot of the people making the most noise were ever Democrats in the first place. Some may just be non-voters. Some may be people who have been voting for Greens going back to Ralph Nader in 2000. And they may just be trying to make sure that that the House and Senate remain in Republican hands because it gives them more to it gives them more opportunities to speciously claim that there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans. It's a theory. The market, of course, by the way, in terms of dollars, it lost over $1 trillion in value. And that's not just walking around money. But, of course, money is never actually lost. It went somewhere. It's in somebody's pockets. But speaking of lost money, there's also this. You ever heard of the Defense Logistics Agency? The Defense Logistics Agency is a department of the Pentagon. It is, in fact, one of the largest agencies in the Pentagon. And they were recently audited. They were audited by Ernst & Young. And Ernst & Young discovered that the Defense Logistics Agency failed to properly document more than $800 million in construction projects. No paper trail for millions of dollars in property and equipment. With financial management so weak that its leaders and oversight bodies have no reliable way to track the huge sums it's responsible for. And Ernst & Young issued a warning based on that initial audit. $800 million. Wow. That's like two of those F-35 fighter jets, isn't it? Being facetious, it's only one. No, whatever. But my God, $800 million. Congress had no problem appropriating that money for the Pentagon. But we had to shut the government down to get the Republicans serious about extending CHIP for six fucking years. The Children's Health Insurance Program. But the Defense Logistics Agency just, not really sure where $800 million went. Piffle. I know. Hey, thanks, big thanks to our buddy Will in Chicago who took us down to $90. And thanks to Samson who just took us down to $55. Samson in northern Wisconsin. One of my favorite places on planet Earth. Where when the Girl Scout cookies thin mints come in, you don't have to waste energy putting them in the freezer. You can just stick them on the windowsill. Thank you, Samson. Thank you very kindly. $55 to go to meet Chris's challenge. That's huge. Randy, with a note, says, the Pentagon's not sure where $6 trillion went over the past 20 years either. You know, one of these days we need to get a bunch of people just to go in and start shaking out the cushions in the sofas there at the Pentagon. As Dennis Kucinich pointed out way back in 2004, we could fund universal single-payer health care in this country on the money the Pentagon loses. Not what they spend, what they lose. The stuff that just falls out of their pockets when they're sitting there with their legs crossed and smoking their pipes and talking with their teeth clenched and polishing their military hardware. Politico, that's where the article came from, by Brian Bender. Bender writes, the audit raises new questions about whether the Defense Department can responsibly manage its $700 billion annual budget, let alone the additional billions that Trump plans to propose this month. The department has never undergone a full audit, despite a congressional mandate. And to some lawmakers, the messy state of the Defense Logistics Agency's books indicates one may never even be possible. Gee, I wonder if that's a mistake. And in wondering if that's a mistake, I, of course, remember Bart Kopp's first law. If somebody makes a mistake and they make a lot of money doing it, expect them to make that same mistake over and over and over and over. Chuck Grassley, useless as a kickstand on a submarine, said, if you can't follow the money, you aren't going to be able to do an audit. Well, thanks. $800 million. Out of a total at the Pentagon of $2.2 trillion in assets. Ernst & Young found that misstatements in the agency's books worked out to at least $465 million for construction projects it financed for the Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies. For construction projects designated still in progress, meanwhile, it didn't have sufficient documentation, or any documentation at all, for another $384 million worth of spending. No documentation for $100 million worth of assets in the computer systems that conduct the agency's day-to-day business. And this is all just based on the fiscal year ending September 30th, 2016. $46 million in computer assets inappropriately recorded. Trying to put the best face on it that he possibly can, Army Lieutenant General Darrell Williams. Really? We've got a general named Darrell. And his other brother, another brother, Darrell, the Admiral.
The initial audit has provided us with a valuable independent view of our current financial operations. We're committed to resolving the material weaknesses and strengthening internal controls around DLA's operations. For Christ's sakes, don't cut the money off.
Yeah. Jim says, oh, hell, Bob, round it off to 9. It's the cost of doing business. I mean, that's... it's all funny money anyway. Because all they have to do, if we start actually thinking about making the Pentagon actually accountable, all some Pentagon spokesperson has to do is walk to the podium and say, Muslims, Bruga, Bruga, Bruga. And a whole bunch of America will, woo, MAGA, 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 Bruga, Bruga, MAGA, MAGA. And the money will miraculously materialize inside the Pentagon coffers once again. That's what I meant when I was talking about the fear and the paranoia a little bit ago. It's like those old beef, it's what's for dinner. No, fear, it's what's for dinner. We've got some serious fear and paranoia running in this country. It's why we're still having a conversation about a stupid ass wall that's as dumbass an idea as this country and as anyone in this country has ever had. I mean, that wall is dumber than Winston Churchill's idea of turning icebergs into aircraft carriers. It's that stupid. But people are terrified that somebody's going to sneak across the border with a suitcase nuke and light up McAllen, Texas. No, really. So I wanted to get the better part of this filibobster in, because Mike's question tied a whole bunch of the issues that we deal with together. naturally, if you want to participate in the program, you're mighty welcome to. We're going to take a little break because filibobstering for two solid hours is thirsty work. But just a gentle reminder that it was first offered up last night, and it comes in beverage form, speaking of thirsty work. To perk you up, infantile innards from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Infantile innards are vegan, gluten-free, free-range, cruelty-free, cage-free innards, freeze-dried and powdered into a capsule form to give you to give you that youthful kick that you need to get through these perilous times. Remember, if you order a 3-month supply of infantile innards from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter, well, by Jove, we'll send them to you with a bundle of test strips for the low price of $111.72 plus postage and handling. We'll send you a bundle of little test strips that you can use to learn what we already know, that in fact, infantile innards from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter is just another bullshit nutritional supplement, like all the other bullshit nutritional supplements that get hustled all across the radio landscape. Remember, you cannot be a professional radio operation without a bullshit nutritional supplement to hustle. So, consequently, infantile innards from Horn Labs, at Horn Labs on Twitter, Horn Nutraceuticals, and the periodontic peripatetic scientists thereof. Remember, accept no substitutes. Ask for it by name. No salesman will call. Your mileage may vary. Infantile innards from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Place foot on housing before cranking. Infantile innards. FOBCODCIA. Pentagon, military-grade innards from Horn Nutraceuticals, at Horn Labs on Twitter. So a break and then conversation if you want to engage in it. I'm Bob. And remember, $55 to go to finish fundraising and meet Chris and Germany's challenge. Thanks, everybody.
Met a girl called Lola and I took her back to my place. Feeling guilty, feeling scared, hidden cameras everywhere. Stop! Hold on. Stay in control. Girl, I want you here with me. But I'm really not as cool as I'd like to be. Cause there's a red under my bed. And there's a little yellow man in my head. And there's a true blue inside of me. Touching you, watching you, loving you. Paranoia, the destroyer. Paranoia, the destroyer. Well, I fell asleep, then I woke, feeling kind of queer. Lola looked at me and said, ooh, you look so weird. She
to help me, please. I know you'll understand. There's a time device inside of me. I'm a self-destructing man. There's a wreck under my bed, and there's a little green man in my head. And said you're not going crazy, you're just a bit sad, 'cause there's a man in you, gnawing you, tearing you.
The genius of the Kinks. And in that case, Destroyer. 6 minutes past the hour on this Moran Monday. And golly Moses, we do have Morans. Chief among them, David Brooks. He's always been a Moran, will always be a Moran. But sometimes he is shocking in his Moranity. This latest thing over that the New York Times allowed him to publish, and God only knows why. In which he imagines himself as a Democratic consultant, telling Democrats to just throw women's bodily integrity and women's rights to manage the workings of their own bodies under the bus in the name of some sort of bullshit both-siderist bipartisanship. Is an exercise in stupid that even David Brooks had to work to reach. How much is our position on late-term abortions hurting us? Oh, Jesus. See, in the world of a David Brooks, women never have abortions because they're medically necessary. Apparently, if Brooks had a uterus, abortion would be sport. 'Cause it's all just so much fun. Read it at your peril. Let's just say that. Let's run over and check in on the phones. Oh, by the way, we're still at 55. Okay, so we've got 52 minutes to do $55 so that we can meet Chris in Germany's challenge. 52 minutes to do $55, and then we'll be done for the evening, which would be awesome. It would be awesome. Thanks, everybody. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Bob, how are you doing on this glorious Monday?
Well, apparently my neighbors are anticipating a little bit of a cold snap tonight, so they've just fired up the coal stove.
Jeez.
And the gag-inducing smoke has entered the studio.
Sucks to be you, living close to those people.
Those people, absolutely.
Yeah. So let me start off with greetings from just north of beautiful downtown Oz. That's my new nomenclature. You have left us here or presented us with a literal cornucopia of topics from which to choose. You could almost blindfold yourself like Lady Justice, reach your old claw in there and pull out anything at random. And it would be worthwhile conversational material. So hats off to you. Where's my hat? Okay, yeah, hats off to you.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I've got a hat, and it's already off because it's kind of hard.
Well,
to
there
put
you
a,
go.
Kind of hard to put a hat on over the headset.
Yeah, what's that? Monty Python's Meaning of Life, the corporate boardroom scene, charts and graphs indicating that more people need to wear hats.
Yes.
Or something like that. I love it. So I don't know. That's my fancy way of saying I don't know where the hell to begin with this thing. So I'll start here. Talking about the budget woes at that dark hole of money sucking, the Pentagon, it reminded me of the 2005 documentary called Why We Fight, not to be confused with the World War II era documentary series, Why We Fight. This is a brand new twist on it,
right,
from 2005. And I believe they go into, it's been years since I've seen it, but I'm pretty sure they go into the cost overruns and just the waste, fraud, and abuse that goes on within those that five-sided wall, what is that called? A five-sided walled structure, behemoth, sitting there in Arlington. Jesus, what a mess.
Yes.
So check that out if you haven't, for those out there in Radio Land. Even Punky liked it.
Oh, that sounded, he sounded a little pissed there.
That little bastard woke me up at least an hour and a half before I was due to get up. And I'm thinking that somebody is going to grow rich by coming up with a ringtone for those who use their cell phone as an alarm clock, okay? A wake-up ringtone that is either the sound of your bird shrieking his little birdie guts out at inopportune times. He literally never does that, you know, while his cage is covered. I cover it up at night. And then when I wake up, when I'm getting the coffee ready, the cheap El Cheapo instant coffee, I'll come back in and pull the cover off and open his little door and, you know, put his food up on top, because he has a food dishes in the cage, but for daytime, just to save him the walk down into the cage, I put a little food up on top and turn his mirror around so he can talk to his little birdie friend in the mirror. But that little bastard was shrieking way ahead of schedule this morning. So that would be a great ringtone for your cell phone alarm clock app. The other one would be, is another one that I sit bolt upright in bed every time I hear it, is the sound of Chirps the cat curling up a hairball. There's something, the resonant sound of that.
Well, you know, it's, what is it, 513 there on the West Coast? From Washington to Tijuana, you have just ruined a lot of people's freaking dinner, Scott. I mean, this one's on you, Buster.
That happens. I suggest they eat dinner later or earlier, as the case may be. But anyway, there's that. So, I'm primed. I was all set for your Bob-a-thon today, and you covered so much good stuff. I mean, you were talking about where there's smoke, there's fire theory of the Russian involvement in the 2016 election process, and it dawned on me the other day that smoke serves a couple of purposes. One being the one I just mentioned, where there's smoke, there's fire. So smoke can suggest the presence of a dangerous fire situation. But smoke can do something else, as in a smoke screen. Okay? It will obscure things that people don't wish for you to see. So smoke actually is our friend, because if you see it on the one hand, it could suggest the presence of dangerous fire. Or if you see it in the other meaning, that is to say a smokescreen put up by the Republicans, that's a signpost saying, you know, look more closely because they're trying to hide something. And they do it. I mean, if you've ever watched that that woman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, doing her dog and pony show in the afternoon, that's all she does is change the subject or reword the questions in her answers, okay, to make it, you know, to because the end result of her little ramblings always end up with the notice, the message, move on, there's nothing to see here. Well, that'll only take you so far. And hell, if we didn't learn that from Watergate, watching Ron Ziegler up behind the podium.
Yeah, but see, I want to just interject for a moment based on what you just said.
Yeah.
And I think it benefits a lot of us to take this to heart. You just said, if we didn't learn that from Watergate, watching Ron Ziegler.
Yeah.
Well, the generation of people who did, I mean, remember, I'm a 12-year-old kid coming home from baseball practice when this shit's happening.
Well, and I had you in mind when I said that. I mean, I'm a
55-year-old man.
Yeah.
That means that the 50-year-olds, nothing. The 40-year-olds, nothing. The 30-year-olds, who was Nixon?
Yeah.
What's a Reagan? And we need to take that into account because it's almost like a magnet and an iron skillet to go, because the back reference is always Watergate because that's the point of reference this generation has.
Yeah.
But we need to figure out some way to explain it to the... And I'm not talking down or punching down or kicking down or any of that. I'm just acknowledging that everybody is not our age. I mean, you've got a few years on me. Sparky's got a few years on me. Ron in the far frozen north got a few years on me. But we got to figure out a way to explain how awful this is without a reference to Watergate. Because once you make that Watergate reference, I fear, Scott,
yeah,
that you lose them.
Well, okay.
Because
then,
Watergate is as far away from them as the First World War is from me. And if you have to explain why Watergate was bad, then you're caught, and then you're caught in the feedback loop of explaining why this, which isn't Watergate, is like Watergate, and then as Turd Blossom famously said, Karl Rove years ago, one of the few things I agree with him on, if you're explaining, you're losing.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's look at this generation you're talking about then, the non-Watergate rememberers, okay? What was the milestone event in their generation where they were lied to and or disappointed and or both? It could be a cultural thing. It could be a newsworthy thing, but there definitely has been.
Oh, I don't know. If you were born in 1975, you were 10 years old when they came out with New Coke.
No, that's not big enough and bad enough. Although I do remember that. That was...
I mean, my eldest daughter turned 30 this year, and she was a baby during the Clinton scandals.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she wasn't even as old as I was when I was coming home from baseball practice when they were impeaching Clinton, and she's 30. In order for the Clinton scandal to be as relevant for that generation as Watergate is to me, you've got to have somebody born in 1985. Thereabouts. So if you were born, you know, if you're an 18-year-old right now, you were a baby during the invasions, the illegal invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've, How do you define what a great moment of betrayal is for people of an age such that they've never known? I mean, really, and I mean, I didn't mean to hijack our conversation this way, but I think
no, but
I think you're capable of going down this road. If all you've ever known is betrayal, if all you've ever known is lying, if all you've ever known is a country at war over bullshit,
yeah.
How do you explain the gravity of it?
Well, it's like explaining water to fish. I mean, water just is.
Yeah. As Robert in Australia points out, 16-year-olds don't remember 9/11. And maybe there's evidence to suggest that the youngest aware generation right now ain't having none of this. For the most part, ain't having none of this Trump bullshit. But here's the rub. To what extent are they likely to be convinced by people with agendas who say things like there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans?
Say that again.
To what extent is a generation of 18 to 25-year-olds susceptible to being lured in by the bullshit arguments of people who say there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans? So, in other words, vote young voters.
Yeah.
You know, Bernie got a lot of young people excited, and that was a good thing.
Yeah.
But then it's almost like an industry rose up behind him in his failure to make sure that generation didn't engage or didn't remain engaged. And a lot of this is terra incognita for me, because most of the youth in this state is as Trumpansy as their mommies and daddies and their grammies and their grampies.
Yeah.
Because we are still at 65% maggot.
Well, and then there's also the risk being run that because they're so accustomed to things being the way that they are, because they have nothing else to compare it to, they could resign themselves to the notion that, well, that's just the way things are.
At which point you have a situation that I refer to as self-normalization.
Yeah.
Or auto-normalization. You know, Will in Chicago, who is an educator and a very thoughtful man and a longtime friend of this program, just remarked, for kids today, anything before their lives is almost as distant as ancient Egypt. And that's true.
Well, and on the weekend, there's this thing on C-SPAN 2 called Book TV, and there's this thing on C-SPAN 3 called American History TV, and one of the programs on one of those channels, I forget which one it is, are lectures. And they go to a college and they videotape a professor giving a talk on a topic of historical import. And there are a bunch of students in the classroom, I'm guessing about 18 or 19 or 20. And those kids get very much engaged with the material. And the professors usually, or instructors, are more often than not very good in making it relevant, something from so far ago, relevant to that generation, so that they can connect it to something that's going on now or not going on now.
Right. And again, that's happening in a college classroom.
Yeah.
It ain't happening in high school classrooms. for the most part.
No, no. Who knows? I mean, and you, part of that problem has to do with the goddamn textbooks that are used in a pretty large chunk of the country that are dictated, the content is dictated by the state of Texas, for Christ's sake. And if Texas doesn't like it, those school boards down there will veto the stuff. So the textbook companies are forced to print books that cater to that lowest common denominator of intellect and knowledge, okay? And rather than have a just for Texas version of the book, they do it the other way. They produce the just for Texas book, and that's the one that becomes used by Arkansas and Mississippi and Louisiana and that, you know, that deep red pocket of states, which is crazy. That's why I was so sorry that one of my nieces and her husband and kids moved from New England down to Texas, down by the Houston area a couple of years ago, because those kids
are educationally doomed.
Well, yeah, their prime education years, if that family stays down in that state, at least in the public school system, are going to be doomed in their prime learning years to be misinformed. And that'll set them up for a whole bunch of bullshit later on down the road. But you're right. I mean,
I think your misgivings are well formed or well reasoned.
But your point just ahead of that is absolutely correct. Yeah, it's all well and good for engagement and learning to go on in the classroom and on the college level, but what about the rest of the youngsters?
Right.
I don't know.
The reason I kind of looped into this issue, I had an agenda, an ulterior motive, Scott. Some new data out from the Southern Poverty Law Center. They wanted to know how many killings associated with the alt-right last year, because the Anti-Defamation League had already done the work to show that killings tied to white supremacists went way the hell up in Nectarine Nero's first year in office. So the SPLC took the data, and they wanted to tease out how many of those killings came from young. Jesus, are you okay?
Yeah, I was. I'm going to take Punky and put him in the other room because he's shrieking. Is aggravating my headache.
Oh, okay. Well, but anyway, so the SPLC wanted to know how many of these killings are being perpetrated by young, brand new Nazis and brand new Klansmen.
Yeah.
And what they found out is that the number of killings and injured persons attributable to the newest generation of white nationalists, you know, racists, I think we can say racists,
no,
has gone skyward. 43 individuals have been killed. 67 have been injured in attacks by the so-called alt-right since 2014. In the past year alone, 17 individuals were killed. An additional 43 were injured. And that's the highest annual rate of all the years in the study. And then, of the 12 alleged or convicted killers connected to this new generation of white supremacists, the average age of perpetrators is 26 years old. Only three have been older than 30, with the youngest being 17. Is that a little bit chilling?
Well, that, and it also shoots a couple of holes into my fond hope, one of them, that would be that it's mostly the older generation who are, you know, seeing life from a dark, smelly place, that is to say their heads are up their asses, and as that generation dies out, they're going to be replaced primarily by a generation of more enlightened people except for the Nazis and the skinheads and the white nationalists and the super-duper, you know, there used to be the young Republicans. I don't know what the fuck they call that branch of young people today.
Oh, no, there's still young Republicans out there, and well, they're awful. But the upshot of the SPLC work is that, and the way it's described here, the transition of young white supremacists from online hate to real-world ramifications, long feared, has finally begun taking place. Given that the White House is effectively uninterested in combating the trend, at times even suggesting that the young men in those extremist movements are associating with very fine people, you remember that, there's little reason to think this pattern will end anytime soon. In other words, there's going to be more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that. You know, I mean, that's a talk about waking up bolt upright in a sweat in the middle of the night. That's a reason for it, and maybe that's why Punky's shrieking.
Well, I mean, given the state of things in the world today, it's a wonder he doesn't shriek nonstop. I mean, come on. I might be up there with him on an adjoining perch, flapping my wings and shrieking my birdie guts out. So, I mean, what, not to minimize any of it, these killings, but did they say what percentage of killings that represents? I mean, because if we're good at anything in this country, goddammit, it's killing people. Okay.
Oh yes.
I mean, it's, and I don't remember things ever being anywhere close to this bad as I was coming up. I mean, hell, we didn't even lock our doors for the most part. You know, kids, especially in the summertime, in the 60s, we'd ride bikes and go everywhere and do everything, and we'd be gone from like 8 o'clock in the morning until well after sunset on a summer day. And I'm sure that there's still some of that by kids today, but then there was that whole generation of parenting which was overprotective and there's a term for it. Is it helicoptering? Is that what it was?
Yeah, helicopter parenting.
Yeah. You know, where kids literally had their entire day mapped out and plotted out, and there was no room for adventure.
Yeah, regimented even.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was talking about the other day in conjunction with the sex abuse horrors. You know, Larry Nassar got another 40 to 125 years today. Good. But it's this idea of and it happens in families that have the wherewithal to do it. Okay, if you're poor, you're not doing it. But you know, just running kids. Just running them, you know, soccer practice and traveling baseball teams and cheerleading competitions in Orlando, and you know, you live in Idaho, and it's all under the guise of I don't know what being afraid that kids left to their own devices will, I don't know, do something awful. Or maybe it's the desperation of a fading middle class that thinks that, well, you know, if I can just get her into the WNBA, she'll have some sort of an income.
Yeah. Well, and that whole thing of the helicopter parenting, it does one of the biggest disservices you can do regarding a child. And I was never a parent. People tell me I missed out on a great adventure and a very satisfying thing, and I'm sure that's true. But to my mind, as an observer, it's a big disservice to kids to bring them up for the first 18 years in such a phony bubble, because sooner or later they're going to get out into the real world, so-called, and they're not going to know how to operate in it. Because as idyllic as I like to recall my childhood as being, at least parts of it, at least on some level I was prepared for adulthood and was not stymied for any length of time when I did stumble or make mistakes, because that's where experience comes from. It comes from wisdom, and wisdom comes from doing stupid shit. And if you hopefully live through it, Oddly enough,
you're echoing something that Nick Foles said in the morning press conference. He said that his success had more to do with his failures than with any previous successes.
Yeah, because success you learn nothing from. And to me, to my thinking, that form of parenting that we're talking about, that overprotective mother henning of children and young people, it's insidious in the damage potentially it can do. Maybe I'm off base with that, never having been a parent, but I
don't necessarily think that you are.
Well, the title of one of the books that the late Nicholas von Hoffman wrote back around 67 or 68. He died just the other day.
Right, yeah, I saw that.
And I used to read his column when he was writing for the Washington Post, and he was on Point Counterpoint on 60 Minutes, and, you know, has written a number of books. But one of the books had a great title, and it was "We Are the People Our Parents Warned Us Against," or warned us about.
Yeah, that went on to be a wonderful little ditty by Jimmy Buffett too.
Yeah, and you've probably seen it also years ago as a bumper sticker. But the title was so great because it's so true. I would like to think that my generation grew up in some measure to be the people that our parents warned us against, because people of my parents' generation, having come up during the Depression years, the wake of the Depression, they were protective too in their own way, okay? But not to the extent that it did us a great deal of harm, because we were still free to explore and rebel, you know, because it's that little button that you used to see years ago, question authority. And that, I mean, if my generation is famous for anything, it's for questioning authority, not just taking everything that's presented at face value. And that's another area with a deficit that this younger generation has, because if they don't know any better, they're not going to ask the questions or form the attitudes that they need to have.
Yeah, but just, see, Scott, even in saying this, and you say that in good faith, okay? You do.
Yeah.
But I was just trying to listen as if my ears were 18 years old. And
what did you hear me say?
And when we say, you know, this generation, if they haven't learned, they're not going to know the right questions to ask. If I'm 18 years old, I tune out after that. And that's not me being mean to you. It's me pointing out the question of how do we transmit intergenerational wisdom without coming across as being, you know, get off my lawn, yells at clouds, lecturer.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's not the same as my generation having nothing worthwhile to offer to this current generation. It's somewhere in the middle.
Oh, no, that's the whole thing. I mean, that goes back to something I've said about previous generations. The Republicans could never even contemplate going after Social Security while my grandmother, born in 1894's generation, was still alive because they had lived through the fucking Depression. They had seen what Republicans did wanted to do to them. Okay?
Well, and they had seen
They had lived through it and damn near died of it.
They had seen the before picture. They knew what life was like before there was Social Security, and then another generation later, before there was Medicare.
Right. And so she passed away in 1985. And oddly enough, that's the same time that you start getting these reforms. She was 91 when she died.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind the fact that she'd been out of her mind for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. But then you, then my parents' generation steps into that space, and you know, 2014, my father would have been 90. So that generation falls away, and lo and behold, now the Republicans can get away with saying, "Well, you know, Medicare's gonna fail, Social Security's gonna fail, we better, oh gosh, we better kill it to save it." And those generations are not standing there now going, "Oh no, you don't." And my generation and yours were inadequately prepared, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Consider the Reagan Democrats. You know, my generation was shooting pool and drinking beer and what have you, while the Congress went about the business of making sure that we have to work, you know, that we work till we fucking die.
Mm-hmm.
And the generation beyond me was like, "Well, okay, as long as it's not going to touch mine, that's all right." And so we were that intergenerational wisdom was not transmitted. It turned to static somewhere before it reached the hearer's ears. And now that, you know, I get a little bit older, I start looking back and I'm thinking, how in God's name do we help them to help to transmit this information? You know, not because we're smarter, but because we're trying to help. And maybe the answer is, you know, "Shut up, old man. We don't want your help. We'll fuck up all by ourselves. Y'all didn't have any problem doing it. Boomers didn't have any problem fucking up. And my parents were that greatest generation bunch. And, well, you know, they raised us."
But that raises a question, Bob. That may well be their attitude. But aren't the stakes a lot different and a lot higher down the road, or even now when they're making the mistakes that they want to be making? I mean, maybe they're not. Maybe it's a continuum. I don't know. These are areas that I never thought we'd be at this point, first of all. I thought, this is shows you how fucking optimistic I've been. Years ago, you go back 30 years, see, 40 years even, 50 years even, I knew in my heart of hearts that by the time I got to be the age that I'm at, to the extent that I could even imagine such a goddamn thing, that the world would be a somewhat more stable place. At least America would be, given all we'd been through prior to my arrival and in the years since. But are we at that point? No, they talk about the parallels between 2018 and 1968 being a strange year from 50, a very strange year from 50 years ago, turmoil filled, okay, batshit crazy, okay. Today is way worse than 68 was. And it's true, we lived through that, but only by the fucking skin of our teeth. Hell, there's some people that are still fighting the battles that were being waged 50 years ago, culturally and politically. and economically. So I don't know. Maybe it's just one big continuum and nothing really is ever designed to change in as meaningful a way as we'd like. This is one of those areas where I just don't fucking know. I mean, I have some rough ideas, but that and 398 will get you a latte down at McDonald's or something.
Cheap latte.
Yeah.
No,
I'm not at the point of despair, but I'm at the point of very intense concern for this young generation and for the future. Simply because when you've got a manifest lunatic who doesn't know truth or reality, if it came up and introduced itself, running the place, and he's surrounded by a mob of fellow know-nothings who know even less than he does, that's not a recipe for much else other than disaster. And then I hear my rational brain saying, well, yeah, but I'll butt myself to death. Yeah, but our system is designed to see us through such nonsense. Well, yeah, it may be designed to do that.
Well, see, you and I part company on that. I think we are outside the boundaries of anything our Constitution was designed to handle.
Well, then what do you do?
You bought the ticket, you take the ride. I mean, I know that's a facile answer, but you don't have access, nor do I, to the necessary power to alter the circumstances. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you know, we've been talking about the Electoral College a bit lately.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, the Electoral College, in its design, was meant to provide the impetus and the power to the electors to stop a Donald Trump from becoming president. In other words, the way that it worked in 2000 and the way it worked in 2016 and the way it worked with Rutherford B. Hayes was actually systemically contrary to how it was supposed to work in the first place. The Electoral College was a buffer there to stop a madman if the people were stupid enough to elect him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, the gender terms, I mean, madman.
Yeah, well.
So that it was not designed to stop someone who won, who didn't win the popular vote from becoming president. It was designed to stop someone who did win the popular vote from becoming president, because in the sober judgment of the electors, that person was not suited to the presidency by reasons that were so obvious as to make it necessary for the continued existence of the country that they overrule the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to work exactly in the opposite fashion. So we're talking about systemic failures at a basic level. And that's why I say over and over again, we have been in a constitutional crisis since his hand came off the Bible, because all the norms are shattered.
Well, personally, I think it was one of those trick Bibles with blank pages. Okay.
Well, but yeah, it may have been a copy of The Art of the Deal with the Holy Bible with a Holy Bible skin on it. But consider the latest, this was a breaking story from the New York Times an hour or so ago. And by the way, with 11 minutes to go, we got $40 to go. Thank you very kindly to Juanita. Thank you, Juanita, so very much. We are down from $55 to go to $40 to go to meet Chris in Germany's challenge. Four people at $10 a piece, one person at $40, two at $20, two at $15,
certainly,
and one at $10. But anyway, that's...
Certainly somebody won some money on that game yesterday.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Kick,
Do you know?
Kick in with a couple bucks.
Do you know there was a freakishly high number of million-dollar bets placed on the Eagles in the week prior to the game?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was following. Apparently, the bookies were having a hard time making the money right all the way up to game time. Because see, that's how you make the money, is you get the money right. You know, it's got
maybe that's connected to the sell-off today on Wall Street.
Yeah, who knows?
Maybe cashing in some of those stock profits to pay off their bets.
But anyway, consider this story that just came in as breaking news from the Times about an hour or so ago. You remember when Marcus Aurelius said that, I can't wait to sit down under oath with Bob Mueller. I'm so going to do that. I'm going to give the best interview. It'll be a better interview than Crooked Hillary could ever have given. Remember that? That was a week or so ago?
Yeah.
Well, John Dowd, Jay Sekulow, and a few of the other noble pleaders surrounding this adipose wad of walking criminality.
Did you say pleaders or bleeders?
Pleaders. Noble pleaders.
Oh. Because they do bleat.
Well, that too. Pettifoggers. Let's go with pettifoggers.
Okay.
They've said, no. We're advising Trump not to sit down and allow himself to be interviewed by Bob Mueller. We don't think it's a good idea. Because they know he's a fucking liar. He won't be able to get past "Hello, my name is" before he's in violation of 18 U.S.C. 1001.
And what ain't fucking liar is Captain Queeg. All that's missing are the little steel bearings.
Yeah.
And talk about the strawberries. You know, Jesus.
So despite him saying that he wants to give an interview and he'll do it under oath, his lawyers are saying, no, Mr. President, sorry, no. Mueller wants to interview you. We're going to make him subpoena you.
Is there?
And then they'll fight the subpoena, and they'll pretend that the entire Clemus hunt of the late 90s never took place, and that the subpoenaing compulsion to testify of Bill Clinton didn't happen in this universe, and that Kellyanne Conway's husband wasn't the guy who made it happen.
Yeah. Because they rely on a grouping of people who don't know. They either deny, or they never knew to start with, or they knew only enough to, you may as well say, they didn't know anything about their own country's history. And recent history at that.
True enough. I find this particular story interesting, though, because I suspect that John Dowd, who was brought in specifically for this investigation, I suspect that he recognizes that for him to allow the president to sit down and testify would actually be legal malpractice on his part.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that his ass would be in a sling.
Well, it's a wonder Trump can get a lawyer, given all the people of different professions that he's burned over the years.
Exactly. So it's more than a little interesting as we move through this process and getting back to the, you know, some of the earlier topicality. I frankly don't understand. I've read this drivel. And I don't understand how you look at all those factors and all those facts and say, "Oh no, there's nothing here." It just it beats cat's fucking.
You faded out there.
Sorry about that. Well, it was just a throwaway line, but I got a note in here from Keith who jumped in and helped out this evening. Bob, the term Watergate is used today is kin to a joke. Every scandal has been gated. I'm 50, and I do remember Watergate and Nixon resigning. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was bad. There's nothing for the younger generation to equate because the term has been overused. There will never be another Watergate. I've heard it said that a scandal such as Watergate would never happen again. To that point, it is true, because what is happening now, I feel, is much, much worse. May we all come through this and still be a standing country. Whatever comes out the other end of this sausage machine is not going to be the same thing that went in. Can we agree on that, Scott?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, we're truly in uncharted territory because of so many factors being so different from anything that most of us have known about or could relate to. It's as if we're through a portal of some sort. Nothing is quite the way it once was.
Through a glass darkly, St. Paul?
Well, it's almost a fucking Twilight Zone episode. I mean, or The Outer Limits, or one of those 60s shows. And that's the scariest part about it. If nothing is reliable, and if then, okay, if X, then Y, then what do you latch on to? You're moving me ever so closer to a we're all screwed, Bob, you know?
Well, you've already been there. You're comfortable saying it, so.
Well, no, I'm not there. I'm not there yet, and that's probably stupid on my part. But I would very much like to think
again, it's there are elements of this that aren't the present but are the future, and that is that one of these days, if the past that we have experienced for the last 18 years is any indication, somebody who isn't a fucking idiot like Trump is going to get his or her hands on the reins of power. I'm not talking about any Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to do, and because of what he has done to the presidency in 1 year alone, they will do harm to this country that we can't conceive. I mean, we're watching people get hauled off Greyhound buses because their papers were not in order.
Yeah.
Okay? We're seeing children torn away from their parents. Parents shipped to lands where they don't even speak the language. Time after time after time after time. What happens when it's not quite so genteel as it is now? What happens when it's just out in the open? Because that day has the potential to come under the hands of, say, a Tom Cotton.
Mm-hmm.
Or any of these other Trumpansy zealots. The Constitution means nothing to them. And if at some point in this process constitutional norms do not obtain, well, what comes out the other end of that shredder is not going to have any constitution, or that sausage maker is not going to have any constitution in it, Scott.
Oh, it'll be dystopian. It'll be revolutionary.
It will be imperial. I've long said that the presidency was imperial in nature, that the president is an imperial administrator. But what happens when you take that imperial administrator and you apply a healthy dose of autocracy to it?
Well, yeah, and then, I mean, it depends on how far down the line we're talking. You ask about what will the response be, what will it look like, what will the result be. It could very well be that there's no response of any meaningful sort.
Well, look at this craven Congress that we have now.
Yeah.
They have no interest. They have no interest in exercising their co-equal constitutional functions. They exist in large part as nothing more than a bunch of bootlicks and lickspittles to Donald Trump. Plain and simple. And if that persists in conjunction with an imperial presidency, it's over. You know, one of it reminds me that, you know, Trump wants people to come from Norway. God damn it! Well, nobody's going to come from Norway because Norwegians have a better life than Americans do, by far. And so, with that in mind, why should they come here? The whole point is to be a lamp in the darkness. As Emma, I lift my lamp beside the golden door, right?
Yeah.
You want to be a better place than where someone is coming from. Well, Western Europe largely got its shit together. So that nobody particularly wants to leave Western Europe, and that's where Trump wants the immigrants to come from. But we're not better than Western Europe. We're better than Bangladesh. We are arguably better than Venezuela. We're better than the Gambia, perhaps.
Instead of Reagan's shining city on a hill, we're the dark, terrible, scary shithole on the hill.
With a big, terrifying orange eye at the top of it. The eye. Yeah, exactly.
Lovely.
Hey, Scott, we got to get out of here, but it's been a wonderful conversation. Thanks for letting me digress like I did.
Well, you've done it, Bob, because you know what?
You're more confused now than you were when you called.
We're all screwed, Bob.
Oh, go fire up Lebowski. You'll feel better.
Okay, take care.
See ya. Bye now.
Bye.
And so we come to the end of the program, a little over the end of the program, and again, we got $40 to keep a $200 challenge from falling off the table. $40. That's where it stands. Hopefully, it will be met in the next few minutes, and we'll be okay, and just start over tomorrow. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to everybody who does keep the program on the air. When I thank people at the beginning of the program, it is more sincere than I can express, because otherwise, no show. Thank you. Thank you to all of you who participate and listen, however you do. Thank you very kindly to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa at headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.